From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Guy Raz. This episode, a cover story. For richer, for poorer, but not as neighbors.
When my mom died, I got so many letters of people wanting this house because this is a gold mine.
Studies show income is the new segregator, money and the way we live now. Also, the African-American highwaymen selling their idealized Florida landscapes.
In all my paintings, if you notice, there's three birds in them. One for the Father, one for the Son, and one for the Holy Spirit.
And then, in the new novel, The People of Forever Are Not Afraid, a former Israeli soldier imagines the lives of others.
I wanted to give people the chance to imagine what the life of someone who is stuck at this border might be like.
Plus the movie that actor Michael Peña could watch a million times, and that rarest of things, a butterfly moth entomologist marriage.
Well, up until about a month ago when we had some colleagues in Finland get married, but we were it until then.
And later, an avant-garde guitarist plays the blues, New York's Elliot Sharp. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. The income gap is receiving a lot of attention lately. It may be greater today than during colonial times, even when you account for slavery. That's what a new study coming out of the University of California and Harvard suggests. More Americans today are isolating themselves around PLUs, people like us, people who earn like us, in this case. Residential segregation by income is on the rise. Those are the findings of a recent Pew study, and we'll get to that in a bit. But first, let's look at a neighborhood here in Washington, D.C., on the cusp of change. Our cover story today, money, the new neighborhood segregator. It's not so much keeping up with the Joneses as living next door to them. Shaw is a neighborhood rich in history whose fortunes haven't always been so stable.
It's historically been the center of African-American culture. Duke Ellington was from here. In its heyday, Shaw was a mecca for all kinds of African-American artists and professionals.
I met up with Peter Tatian, a researcher at the Urban Institute, for a walking tour around Shaw. Change is in the air here. Construction sounds clatter and bang as a new supermarket goes up. But the residential street we walk down is something of an oasis.
This is a hot part of town.
This is just a really charming street. I mean, the architectural details, no two houses are alike. You know, parquet brick for the sidewalks and beautiful tall mature trees and, you know, pretty desirable. Mm-hmm. And on all the lower floors, bars on the window.
Right.
Those window bars are the legacy of a less stable time in Shaw's past.
In the 1960s, during the riots that happened after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, this neighborhood, along with a lot of other inner city neighborhoods, was severely affected by the damage that was caused by rioters. That was sort of the beginning of a long decline.
But that decline is reversing. Over the past 20 years, 1,000 new people have moved into the neighborhood where Peter Tatian and I strolled. Many of these newcomers are high-income residents. The average family income in and around Shaw in 1979 was less than $50,000. That's adjusted for inflation. Today, it's more than doubled.
And the question is whether that's a sustainable mix or whether this is just, you know, going to take a little more time and then we're just going to see all upper income people.
And while the mix today is a diverse one economically,
if you look at the trend, one maybe has got to be pessimistic about what the future might hold.
My name is Michelle P. Baylor.
Michelle Baylor has lived through many of these changes in LaDroite Park, a historic enclave within Shaw. Michelle and her family have been in the same house there for nearly a century. She points to a framed photo on her living room table.
This is my grandfather. He's the one that got the house in 1929. My mom, she got married in 1950, right there.
She got married right standing there, right in front of this window.
Her and my dad.
Really? Mm-hmm. Wow, this house has so much history for
yes.
you.
Enough history that Michelle wouldn't think of budging, even as she's seen some of her old neighbors go.
A lot of people who did not own these houses, they could not afford to keep them because they were going up. These are million-dollar homes around here. When my mom died, I got so many letters of people wanting this house because this is a gold mine. Mm-hmm. I just tore it right up. They would have turned this house around, probably made it a condo. Mm-hmm. That's what they have done to a lot of these houses on the block.
In the 1950s, Michelle's grandfather was something of a neighborhood watchman. He worked for the public school system, where he got Michelle's father a job.
Everybody in this neighborhood, they worked. And my grandfather, he was the type of person, he looked out for people and he found jobs for people because that's just what was in his heart.
A relative newcomer to LaDroit Park is Myla Moss, who bought her home in 1999 for about $150,000. Today, it's worth $500,000. She went to school at nearby Howard University, but back then, she wouldn't walk through the neighborhood she now calls home due to the crime and drugs. Now, as advisory neighborhood commissioner, she's working to preserve LaDroit Park's history, including the renovation of the historic Howard Theater.
This was the first African-American theater in the country that allowed black performances, allowed black audiences. And this was the start of amateur night with Ella Fitzgerald. And when I purchased my home, I began to be educated by many in the community about the history.
We're looking at income disparity in neighborhoods, income segregation. Are you worried as someone who's obviously in love with this neighborhood, just generally about this notion of poorer people being segregated, and for that matter, more affluent people segregated and not even seeing the problems of poorer people?
I am worried about that. Economic disparity is growing, unfortunately, and it's cost prohibitive to move into this community anymore. And I think that the affluent residents want the non-affluent residents to be here.
You do? You think they want them here?
Yeah, I do. I don't think that they are acting in malice and trying to move people out. I really don't. I think everybody on the planet wants a nice neighborhood, a good school, a good hospital to go to, a grocer. Young people who come to Washington to work on the Hill and to do policy and find a way to buy a home are not seeking to change the community. They're thinking to be a part of it.
Paul Taylor has studied the shift in neighborhood income segregation. He's with the Pew Research Center and co-author of the recent study, Tracking Its Rise.
30 years ago, about 9% of all upper-income people lived in predominantly upper-income neighborhoods. That share is now doubled to 18%. The share of lower income living in predominantly lower income neighborhoods has also grown. 30 years ago, it was 23%. Now it's 28%.
So you are seeing people basically living with people whose income levels are a lot like theirs.
We're seeing a trend in that direction. It remains the case that the heavy majority of people or households are in census tracts that are predominantly either middle class or mixed. But it's a little bit less so than in the past. 30 years ago, something like 86% of all households lived in such either majority middle or majority mixed neighborhoods. Now it's down to 75%.
Why is this happening?
This was a broad trend. We looked at all the major metropolitan areas in the country. The same trend I've described has played out in 27 of the top 30. So this is pretty much a national trend. The local variance probably goes to lots of factors. And I think in-migration has been a major factor in some of these cities. Just the layout of the cities, the physical, geographic, topographical layout may have be a factor. Historical settlement patterns, the nature of the local economy, the nature of the local workforce, housing discrimination, real estate practices, on and on it goes.
So, Paul Taylor, a lot of people would say, well, this is self-evident. Of course this is going to happen. What's the big deal?
Well, yeah, listen, like tends to attract like. What's the big deal? One of the things we say to ourselves as a country right from the beginning is e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And that's been part of the magic of America throughout our entire history. We are a place that lots of different people come, and they have different income levels, the wealth levels, they have different racial and ethnic backgrounds, immigrant backgrounds, and all the rest. And yet somehow we do make it work. There is a common America. You know, we are in a political moment where the sense of the middle, the sense of the cohesion isn't feeling particularly robust. There is a profound polarization of the electorate. And one outcome of that is a sense that the political process is ossified, polarized. Washington doesn't work. The public feels that way. So frankly, part of the reason for the political ossification has to do with gerrymandering, has to do with the way that we draw lines, and increasingly folks who draw the lines in state after state do so to create safe districts, whether for Republicans or Democrats.
Paul Taylor, Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Now, here's something else that caught our eye in this Pew study that we've been talking about. The top three cities where residential segregation by income is most extreme are all in Texas: Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. There, about a quarter of upper-income households are in majority upper-income areas. So to find out why Texas seems to be ground zero for this trend, I spoke to sociologist Steven Kleinberg. I asked him, what's going on in Texas?
There is land in this region of the country. There is open spaces. Houston was built on a crummy little bayou 50 miles from any natural barrier in any direction. No mountains, no big streams or lakes. And people have the option here that they have more difficulty elsewhere to live in what we were calling the PLUs, living in communities made up of people like us. We tend to be uncomfortable when large numbers of people have much more money or much less money than each of us living in these communities. And people in Houston have a better opportunities to express that because we've got all these subdivisions and gated communities and so on all around the region.
Now, at the top of this show, we went to neighborhoods in D.C., Shaw and LaDroite Park in Washington, and heard a lot about what a tight-knit middle-class community meant historically and how people could talk to and help each other, and that's often called social capital. Are we losing that?
Well, social capital is critical. We tend to think of resources as human capital, education and financial capital, money in the bank. But social capital that connects you to the opportunities that are out there, that provide support systems when you're having difficulty. When you're segregated by income, it means that there's an isolation of the rich just around other rich people with no real sense of how the other half of America is living and struggling today. And if you're isolated as a poor person in poor communities, you have no access to the opportunities that emerge when people have good jobs that are connected to new opportunities that are out there. And the networks and the information systems and the opening of doors occurs much less in these isolated worlds than when we were all part of a single community.
That's sociologist Steven Kleinberg, co-director of the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University in Houston. Here's a stat from the Economic Policy Institute that speaks to the way we live now. In the 1960s, a typical CEO earned about 20 times what a typical worker would. Today, that number is close to 400 times as much. E pluribus unum. It may be the American ideal, but perhaps not really the way we live now. And now, a story I happened upon this past winter on a drive through central coastal Florida in the town of Fort Pierce. Route 1 is now dominated by strip malls and fading condos, but the Florida of the 1950s and 60s was a candy-colored Eisenhower Kennedy space-age dream of flaming red poinciana trees and untamed beaches. This setting gave way to the improbable rise of the highwaymen, young African-American painters making their fortunes in the Jim Crow South. The paintings are boldly colored landscapes depicting scenes that used to be common in this part of Florida. Moss-draped live oaks hanging over moonlit river inlets, delicate white egrets flying across a brilliant orange sunset, palm trees that arch like sabers over the ocean. All painted by the highwaymen on boards made of leftover construction material, and all sold by the group's smooth-talking salesman, Al Black.
Good morning. So my name is Al Black. I have some oil paintings. I want to know what you all be interested if it wouldn't take up too much of y'all's time.
With that pitch, 50 years ago, Al Black would trawl up and down US 1, looking sharp, driving a 1962 blue and white Ford Galaxy. Fresh Florida landscapes packed in his trunk.
And most of the time, they would say, yes, I look. And once they look, I would sell them some.
They sell for thousands now. They're collector's items, owned by celebrities like Shaquille O'Neal and Steven Spielberg. Highwaymen paintings hang in the Florida State House and at the White House.
people started going at these paintings like wildfire.
Mary Ann Carroll is a tall, gray-haired woman in her 70s now. But decades ago, she was a young divorcee with 7 kids, picking citrus and doing odd jobs to put food on the table. One day, she saw a black man painting those beautiful coastal scenes, and her eyes fell on his car.
Flames printed on the side on the fender. Then he looked in the back and showed me he had a painting in there, I guess to prove that he was an artist. And so I said, will you show me? He tacked me up a little 18 by 24 board. And when I got through, it looked all right, but it was just naked. So what he did, he put 2 palm trees in it. And I sold the painting. I don't remember where I sold it. I don't remember how much I sold it for.
For Carroll, it started as a way to make a living. But the original highwayman painter, the man who started it all, was a teenage artist named Alfred Hare.
Alfred was a smart dude.
James Gibson, Alfred Hare's best friend and fellow painter.
He could paint fast, the people buying the painters real fast. He went selling paint like $19 and $20.
You can paint 4 or 5 paintings in a day. That's $100 a day. But you got to go ahead and sell your paintings.
Back in the 60s, Alfred Hare, a charismatic and talented high school student from a good family, was taken by his art teacher across the railroad tracks, literally the color line in Fort Pierce, to see a famous local artist and humanitarian named A.E. Beanie Backus.
Alfred had gone down to Mr. Backus. Mr. Backus was a famous white artist.
James Gibson remembers it this way.
At this particular time, his doors opened to anybody who was interested in art, black, whatever, white, anybody. And if you're interested, he'll teach you. And so what happened, Alfred sold his first painting. Then he wrote and told me, James, I went to Mr. Bankers and he taught me how to paint. And if I did it, I know you can do it.
They were making money and happy to show it. At the dog track, on fancy cars, on women. No one lived like the highwaymen. There was envy from other men. One night, it came to a head at a juke joint called Eddie's Place.
Me and him went out and he said, meet me down to Eddie's Place.
The events of that night have become as epic as a blues song. All the highwaymen tell slightly different versions of what happened. Al Black, Alfred's top salesman, claims he was at Eddie's that night.
Alfred went over to the jukebox and pushed war. What did you good for? Absolutely nothing. J.L. shot him in the chest.
Alfred Hare was 29 years old, and he died that night.
When we took him to the hospital, I was the only one standing by the bed when he died.
I am the one that talked to Alfred last.
Artist James Gibson.
He was trying to tell me something, and I put my ear. Then Dr. Goose came in and said that Alfred has retired.
When Alfred Hare died, the enterprise of the highwaymen nearly died with him. Demand dwindled. By the 90s, the painters had all but stopped, which left their salesman, Al Black, with no paintings to sell. He started making his own, but that led to other problems.
That's right. You can have foot trouble, back trouble, neck trouble, all kind of trouble. You ain't had no trouble until you have some crack cocaine trouble.
He was caught up in drug addiction and was accused of fraud. Al Black ended up in prison, where he'd spend 12 years adorning the state prison system with his signature murals. He's out now, but we went with him to the Central Florida Reception Center to take a look at some of his masterpieces painted right on the cinder block walls of the prison.
This is early morning, back with Morrissey. It's a real popular painting. And I wanted to paint something that it would keep me busy and it would also make the inmates feel better with the painting shrine.
Not all the highwaymen were sidetracked so dramatically. Most had day jobs, families, or moved out of state. But James Gibson kept painting prolifically. He showed us his paintings the old-fashioned way, pulling them out of the trunk of his white Cadillac Escalade.
Wow. Just the mangroves.
Ooh, this look at that.
You get all the brilliant colors, bright orange, yellow. When it get cold, you look at these colors and warm you up mentally.
That is really lovely.
If you want yellow, Gibson will paint it for you in yellow or blue or orange. The Highwaymen have come a long way since the days of their first efforts. A book written about them in 2001 helped put them back before the public eye. They started painting again, going to little festivals. They started becoming better known than the white painter who'd inspired them, Beanie Backus. And that has caused tension and resentment in Fort Pierce.
Some of them are really horrible, ugly paintings.
Kathleen Fredericks watched Backus paint as a girl. Now she's the executive director of the Backus Gallery and Museum. And as Backus's legacy is overshadowed by the Highwaymen, her relations with the painters have become more and more bitter.
There's a reason that they were viewed as motel art. A lot of those images were conceived of because they came to Backus' studio and they said, oh, Ponciana trees, that look, that he's selling a lot of those. Palm trees, these ranch scenes, they couldn't go out and paint paintings on the Adams Ranch. They'd have been run off and shot.
Words that hint at more than a small-town art spat, perhaps vestigial racial tension from Jim Crow to the present. The city of Fort Pierce recognizes the Highwaymen, but still doesn't seem to know how to include them. Again, female Highwaymen artist Mary Ann Carroll.
Well, we had a struggle, and there's still a struggle here in St. Lucie County. Kid you not. And rather like the Bible says, a prophet is not without honor except in his own hometown. I mean, I can tell you, I love you. You shake your hand and hug your neck. But deep within, am I telling the truth? It's going to show.
Recently, the Highwaymen have formed a nonprofit group to protect their interests, but the individual Highwaymen have also diverged to pursue individual careers. Some, like James Gibson, operate small galleries. Others live precariously. White collectors dominate the market, while the Highwaymen travel to art festivals around the state. As he prepared for a festival in faraway Tallahassee, we visited Al Black in the paint-splattered tent that serves as his backyard studio. Out of prison now, he makes a living selling his own paintings. He told us he hoped to finish 6 more to bring with him that weekend. Sounds like a lot, but he already had 4 going at once.
This is going to be a Backwood Marsh scene. This is going to be a Moonlight in the Indian River. And this is going to be down at the dock where they put the boats in the water.
Today, Al Black is one of the few Highwaymen artists who still paints this way. Outdoors, several canvases at a time. It's this kind of assembly line technique that makes some people question whether this is really art. Al Black is certain it is.
See, for instance, these paintings, what I'm painting on right now, these some good paintings because I'm putting my heart into them.
The raw paintings at first looked like they might be a beach scene, a strip of tan, a yellow sun, a blue background.
You've prepared the sky, the horizon, the ocean, and the reflection.
This is what you call cleaning it up.
Blending everything.
That's right. According to what you want to paint that day, you can start it off different. See, I don't do all my paintings like this. These moonlights, these are here the hard ones. See, most of the people, if they put that blue and that green and that black and stuff, it'll turn into mud.
As Al speaks, he takes black paint and daubs on yellow. And suddenly, it's not a beach scene at all. It's the mangroves and palms at night on the water. And that transformation is the story of art and of young black Florida painters, now elderly, who once drove up and down Highway 1, selling wet-to-the-touch landscapes out of the trunks of their cars.
I think Al's nearly done.
No, he's not done. I'm putting the birds in him. Then all my paintings, if you notice, there's 3 birds in them. There's 1 for the Father, 1 for the Son, and 1 for the Holy Spirit.
To see a video of Al Black's and hear his sales pitch, and to see him painting and more of the Highwaymen art, please go to our website, npr.org. Check out the Highwaymen Interactive. Our thanks to videographer Dave Anderson of Southward and the Oxford American Magazine. Also, our thanks to Gary Monroe, who's documented the Highwaymen in books and whose photos are featured in NPR's Picture Show blog. And a special thanks to the producer of the Highwaymen series, Liz Baker, who was a great sidekick out on the road. Like most Israelis, Shani Boyanju served a mandatory 2 years in the Israeli Defense Forces starting at the age of 18. Now, at the ripe age of 25, she's drawing from those experiences in her first novel. The People of Forever Are Not Afraid began as a school assignment while Boyanju was majoring in English at Harvard. It follows three friends, Yael, Avishag, and Leah. They struggle to reconcile the rigors of army service with typical teenage angst, a whirlwind of boys, body armor, and bad behavior. Borders are a theme throughout the novel, both the border between girlhood and womanhood and the borders between nations. Shani Boyanju joined me from Tel Aviv to talk about her new book and began by talking about the importance of borders.
Israel is such a small country that basically everywhere you go, there's a border. I think that's one of the things that distinguishes it. And at least for me, you know, the Lebanese border has been a huge part of my life because I live so close to it. There's this surreal experience. In a normal world, you could take your car and drive for 30 minutes and be in Lebanon. But of course, you know, that's not how it goes. Plenty of people pass through borders, but they don't spend much time thinking about the people who are constantly at a border, such as soldiers, particularly Israeli soldiers. So I wanted to give people who have passed through these borders the chance to imagine what the life of someone who is stuck at this border might be like.
I really liked how you did that on both sides. You have your young women soldiers thinking about the lives of the Palestinians who are passing in front of them. One of your protagonists mentions the life of this man called Fadi and is able to be quite empathetic, and then one day Fadi becomes an attacker. The kind of segue from what seems safe to what seems dangerous in just a second.
I wanted her to want to imagine him, but I also, one can talk a lot about understanding and of how, you know, if we could only see the other side as a human being just like us, a lot of problems will be solved. And I wanted to show that just because Israelis and Palestinians, I believe, are not a strange kind of humans, you know, they are able to feel for each other. But just because you're able to walk a mile in another person's shoes doesn't mean that the conflict will be solved in any way.
Shani Boyanju, this book has been called a combination of a classic war novel, such as the American author Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is about American soldiers in Vietnam, and a movie like Mean Girls with Lindsay Lohan. I know that many of these incidents are imagined or compiled from things that actually happened, but I would like to know about one of your worst days when you were serving in the IDF.
When the Second Lebanon War just broke out.
We're talking about 2006?
Yeah, and a boy I went to school with was recently kidnapped in Gaza, Gilad Shalit. Obviously, he's since been released. The war started, and everybody was very worried. People were dying, missiles were falling. And then I had to take the trip to bring some stuff from my home, and I had to pass through Tel Aviv. And what really astounded me was that everywhere in Tel Aviv, people were eating in cafes and walking down the streets and sitting in a park and just having a summer. And there are even, you know, some graffiti against the war and against the soldier. I remember feeling very hurt and just very, I guess, confused too. It was almost shocking.
There's a very compelling scene where one of your protagonists, Yael, instructs a young man who can't shoot. And then something happens. She is terrified that Boris has actually killed some boys. Yael likes the Palestinian boys who sort of hover at the edge of the camp. Or at least she can see into their lives.
Yeah, she's an 18-year-old girl. Maybe she's 19 in that story. And the word like, I just wanted to put it into context, you know, the word like, the word hate. For a 19-year-old person, you like whoever entertains you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't like whoever bores you, you know. In some cases, it's as simple as that. And the Palestinian boys in this story start stealing all types of stuff from the base. And that's actually based on not the whole story, but just one time a few Palestinian kids stole the fence of one of the bases I was stationed in. And I just thought that was so funny and so ballsy. You know, here we are, guarding at all hours of the day and making sure that no one enters the base, and then just up and take the fence itself. I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah. Did you write the book in Hebrew or English?
I wrote the book in English.
I wondered.
Strangely enough.
And why so?
Well, I never set out to write a book. You know, I never thought that I would publish my work, certainly not this young. I just took some creative writing classes at Harvard, and for those classes, I obviously had to submit my work in English. One thing led to another, and at the end of it, I had a whole book, and it was all in English. It just sort of happened, but I think that it really helped my writing, because when I write in Hebrew, you know, I can write pages and pages and not really think about every single thing that I'm saying. But with English, it's not my native language. I sometimes have to search for words to see how other people use the words I'm about to use, to make sure that I'm using them in the way that I want to use them.
But I think what you've translated is really a universal language, and that is the experience of the boredom and the terror and the frustration of conflict. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Shani Boyanju is the author of the new novel, The People of Forever Are Not Afraid, and you can read an excerpt on our website. We've been asking filmmakers, actors, writers, and directors about the movies that they watch over and over again, including this one from the breakout star of Crash.
One, two.
How's it going? My name is Mike Pena. I'm an actor, and the movie that I've seen a million times, maybe even more, is Broadway Danny Rose, written and directed by Woody Allen, starring Woody Allen himself and Mia Farrow. I saw Broadway Danny Rose, I think, you know, when I first started acting. The thing that I loved was the storytelling.
Do you know that when I broke into this business in New York, that I could play at least...
It opens up and, you know, and you have these comedians. They're doing amazing jokes, you know, and they're really funny and inventive.
You know about the hotels being expensive.
Right.
How much it costs to stay, like $150 a day for a sleeping room. And I said to the clerk, what's cheap? He said, I got a room for $10, but you got to make your own bed. And I said, I'll take it. So he gave me a hammer and a board and some nails. And that's the joke.
You know, you get into the world of, like, what it is to be a comic.
It was backstage at the Sullivan Show. You were brilliant. And I was there with Danny Rose. Remember Danny Rose?
You know, so you're looking and they're like, oh, did I tell you the story about Broadway Danny Rose? You know, he was a manager. And he had the rarest acts of all time.
You're looking for somebody for Memorial Day weekend. My blind xylophone player, okay? The man would be perfect for your room.
I'll tell really? You, it's old Jewish people. They're blind. They ain't gonna pay to see a blind guy.
Broadway Danny Rose is a manager of like these artists, and you know he's not very successful, but he goes out of his way for like every act that he has.
What about Eddie Clark's Penguin? That's a perfect Eddie Clark and his Penguin. The Penguin skates on the stage dressed as a rabbi. It's hilarious. The Penguin's got a beard like.
And then there's this guy that Lou Canova, who's played by Nick Apollo-Forte, you know, the singer. He's trying to make a comeback, and so Danny helps him.
Did you do the three S's?
Strong, smile, star. I know I every time. You tell me every time.
Right. Yeah. And then what you should do is my funny Valentine after you do great crooners from the past to a deceit.
But he's helping him with this one specific problem, and the problem is Lou's mistress, Tina, who's played by Mia Farrow. Lou wants Tina to be at his concerts.
Danny, would you do me a favor tomorrow night?
Whatever, you name it, you got it.
I want you to bring Tina. I'm really crazy about her.
The only thing is that, you know, he's married, so Danny has to take over, and you know, while he's trying to get her, Danny Rose falls in love with her.
You're a smooth talker.
Yeah.
Angelina once even predicted I would marry a Jew.
Did she happen to say which Jew?
Yeah, a Jew or someone musical.
It's a movie about the absurd. One of my favorite scenes is a scene where he has this woman playing music with wine glasses.
She is the Yasha Heifetz of this instrument. She is really something. You got to see this, Philly. It's absolutely incredible.
He's trying to pitch her to the guy, and he's like, I forget how it goes exactly, but he's like, not one lesson, never taken one lesson.
Never took a lesson. Self-taught. Next year, Philly, my hand to God, she's going to be at Carnegie Hall.
For some reason, it just tickles my funny bone every time I see that movie. You know, if I'm going through the guide and I'm like Broadway Danny Rose, it's almost like an event.
That's actor Michael Pena talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Woody Allen's Broadway Danny Rose. Pena's new film is called End of Watch. It's in theaters now.
I used to think this recording of Poor Butterfly by Judy Garland was perhaps the most romantic take on the subject.
Poor butterfly.
The subject being butterflies.
Neath the blossoms waiting.
Until last week, when I stumbled on the home of Dr. Jason Hall, one of the world's leading entomologists, having described 150 species of the butterfly known as Rhodinidae.
I work at the Smithsonian on neotropical butterflies, and this is my wife, Alma Solis, Dr. Alma Solis.
Nice to meet you, Dr. Alma Solis.
Hi. Well, I work for USDA at the Natural History Museum, and that's where I met my husband.
Dr. Jason Hall and Dr. Alma Solis live in Silver Spring, Maryland, in a house that has one big butterfly garden, which they created themselves. He's identified more butterflies in his yard, around 50, than exist in all of his native England.
Pearl crescents, the Papilio glaucus, the big yellow swallowtail, cabbage whites, white spotted skipper.
As a couple, they are more rare than even the brilliant green and blue butterflies that Jason collects and classifies in Ecuador. Even more rare than some of Alma's moth sightings in Mexico.
We're the only moth butterfly couple up until about a month ago when we had some colleagues in Finland get married. But we were it until then.
So here's their story, starting with how they met at the Smithsonian almost a decade ago. Now, there are a scant few songs about moths, so we threw in a few other butterfly songs in here because, you know, why not?
Poor butterfly.
We actually, when I arrived, Alma was on sabbatical. So there was this empty office next to mine. So, of course, when she showed up a few months after I arrived, I was curious to find out who was in this office. So I went and introduced myself. We went out to the movies, and then one thing led to another.
For she loved him so.
You've got a big smile on your face.
Well, you know, I've always had to deal with the idea that sometimes that if you get married, your partner may not share the same interest. And, I mean, how do you tell your husband that you're going into the field with men for 3 months and that you're going to have to share tents and all this? I mean,
it's like, oh, I'm going to Guyana for a month. Okay, honey, see you later. Well, it's a very unusual shared passion.
Yes, yeah.
The moon and I.
He works during the day and I work at night. I collect my moths at night. So traveling together and looking at our organisms is very difficult.
Yeah, this is true. We had different backgrounds.
Yeah, but yeah. I came to it late. Most of my colleagues, my male colleagues,
are more like me. Little kids collecting bugs and jars.
But, you know, all this kind of thing. I mean, I was an English major when I went to college. And then I learned that they had this biological station in northeastern Mexico, and it was the most amazing place I'd ever seen. I mean, the trees are humongous. I mean, you know, they're 100 feet tall, 90 feet tall, and everything glistens, and the clouds move in, and you just see things that you've never seen before. And I thought, I want to spend my life discovering and learning new things. And so then I just started taking science classes.
Butterfly.
So in Ecuador, there's one day on a ridgetop in cloud forest where I discovered two new species of Rhodinidae butterflies on the same day. And they're beautiful creatures. They're very small. They have incredible metallic blues and greens, long tails, bizarre wings shapes, orange and blue markings with iridescent silvery blue line down the outside of the wings. Just very beautiful.
What I remember is my very first time collecting moths. The way we do it is we put a sheet out, we put a special light to bring the moths in. And I remember very distinctly this sheet just full of moths, and then the bats coming in just to try and get some dinner. The very first time, and I was there all by myself, and that was really scary to me. But I got over it.
But I'm crazy about you, you butterfly.
And for his butterflies, you have to climb to the top of mountains, basically.
Well, if you're moss, you put out the sheet, and the moss come to you. The moss come to you. But to catch butterflies, you have to go to
the... You hike. It's a lot harder. You hike straight up, right?
It's not like walking around the garden here, where everything's just, you know, like a foot off the ground. It's a cathedral. They could be 10, 20 meters up. You butterfly. And this is why, of course, we're finding new species. The rarer things fly higher up.
There's been so much destruction, too, of course, in the Amazon and territory there. That's also got to be another concern, too.
It is a big concern. I mean, almost every time I go back, obviously you're going back to places that you found before, and you find places that have been cut. And I've just cried like a baby. On one occasion, I cried like a baby when I got there. I'd found... you know, a couple of new species. I was trying to find like the male of something that we'd found the female of that was a new species, and I couldn't even find the location, the exact place where I'd found it before, because what was a beautiful forest was now a field.
Entomologists like us, we live for going out into the field, and so when we first met, we talked a lot about where we'd conducted field work and what we'd discovered, and you know, what we wanted to do in the future, and where we wanted to go collecting or where we wanted to go study.
So when you come back, and now we're sitting here in, you know, suburban Maryland, it must seem a little tame.
Definitely. It's very quaint.
It's quaint, yes.
Compared to thigh-deep mud and, Western Ecuador, yeah. But that's part of the reason to have a little butterfly garden is, you know, when you're not in the field, keeps the butterflies close, keeps them in sight, you know, reminds you of what you enjoy doing.
Jason Hall and Alma Solis live in Silver Spring, Maryland. Thanks, too, to the Friends of Sligo Creek for that story. Time now for music and the interesting yin and yang that is Elliot Sharp. In the 1980s, he was the height of New York City cool, a central part of the experimental music scene there. Elliot Sharp's challenging creations were inspired by advanced mathematical concepts, including this piece, informed by fractal geometry. Uneasy listening, for sure. But Elliot Sharp has an alter ego. With his side band, Terraplane, he transforms from New York avant-garde aesthete to down and dirty Chicago bluesman. This is called Down on the Block. It's from Elliot Sharp's new album with Terraplane, Sky Road Songs. He says he's loved the blues since his first year studying science at Carnegie Mellon University.
I would go to the library and take out records and heard some things, you know, that summer in Pittsburgh. And the thing that always resonated with me the strongest was the acoustic guitar, often played with a slide imitating the voice, and a keen, powerful, passionate voice. And it just hit a resonant chord. Lazy man dreaming. The blues is very American. I feel very much part of the continuity of what it means. You know, I mean, obviously a little bit as an outsider, as a suburban white kid, you know, I was looking in, but also being moved by the history of the music and the people that made it. And I had to find a way to channel that language through my own fingers.
The producer you're working with, Joe Martin, he contributed a song here called Banking Blues. And you liked it so much, you've included it twice on this album, two different arrangements. What led to that decision?
It was more a question of finding a way into the song. One was a very kind of studio synthesized production, and the other was the way we might play it if we were playing at a neighborhood bar. Yeah. I got the banking blues. Ain't gonna go away.
We're gonna pay their way. We're gonna pay their way. We're gonna
that take just happened very spontaneously in the studio. We just said, well, let's try it this way. First take, we played it. It was good, done.
And Joy's singing, I got the banking blues, ain't gonna go away, too big to fail dues, we're gonna pay their way. I was thinking that this really, in a very updated way, plays into the tradition of blues music, in that this is a different way of trying to cope in hard times, but it's still that, which is, of course, a traditional blues trope.
And also, blues has always had an element of social commentary. Willie Dixon was the master of that. His lyrics often, I mean, he was a devout pacifist, and these qualities came through in many of his songs, and, you know, one of our great heroes.
My guest is guitarist and composer Elliot Sharp. His new album with the band Terra Playing is called Sky Road Songs. So I had bumped into you in New York. My favorite little neighborhood restaurant, Aliseo's, owned by Albano Ballerini, and there you are playing. I couldn't believe it. There's like maybe eight tables in that place.
You know, I had no idea what to expect. Francesco asked if I'd play, and I'm always happy to play, especially if there's a free evening, and it was a pleasure. I felt like I was in Europe, actually, more than in Brooklyn.
One of the people that you brought up was Hubert Sumlin from Chicago, and he's worked with you quite a few times. He's on this new album. He was Howlin' Wolf's guitarist, just a true legend, who died this past December. Tell me about your experience with him.
Well, Hubert was one of the sweetest guys on the planet, as well as a brilliant and visionary guitarist. He was one of the first to really make the electric guitar speak. He would provide commentary for Wolf, little guttural sounds, strange kind of swoops, very, very modern, very timeless.
I have a little red rooster, too late to crow for day.
I first met him in Chicago in a little dive in 1983, and we talked for a while, and then through another singer I was working with, I began to back him up and then produced some records of his, and then he joined us with Terra Playing. We went to Europe a number of times with Hubert to play concerts and tours, and he was always just such a pleasure to hang out with. And as well, I mean, I've sat next to Hubert many, many times watching his fingers, and I'll still never be able to figure out how, with this incredible economy of motion, he gets these amazing sounds out of his guitar.
We can hear him here. Now, you write in the liner notes, thanks to Hubert Sumlin for gracing our music with his magic fingers and pearls of blue wisdom. You yourself have taught a lot. Give me an example of his wisdom that maybe you'll pass on to some of the people that you collaborate with, and I know you talk to students too.
Well, for Hubert, I think the main thing, and something that anyone who's involved in the arts needs to do, is to find out who they are. And that process, of course, is different for everyone. With Hubert, he explained it as getting fired by Wolf many times until he found his own sound.
Since that sweet loving woman left me, can't bring myself to walk through that door.
Elliot Sharp. His new album with the band Terra Playing is called Sky Road Songs, and you can sample a few tracks on our website, nprmusic.org. Elliot Sharp, and I love how you sang it, an E and the sharp sign, right?
Yeah, it's been that way for years.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Jack.
Ending September 23rd, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show is directed by Brent Bachman. Our production staff includes Kenya Young, Lawrence Silverman, Phil Harrell, Lily Percy, Brenda Salinas, and Amy Held. Our interns are Brenda Sprunt and Acacia Squires. Bethony Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtig is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.